Hey guys, welcome back to the Why Wars Happen History podcast, where you learn about the causes of wars and things like, why did it happen? Was it inevitable? Who was involved? Sometimes I go back hundreds of years just so we can understand what the hell happened. And if you want to talk more about war, we also have authors, historians, war generals, royalty, actors, filmmakers, a whole bunch of people come on as guests, and we talk about everything about war before, during, and after war. So let's go. Welcome to the Why Wars Happen History podcast, where we sit down with filmmakers and historians and talk about wars in history. Today, our guest is Dr. Jeffrey Warrow, professor of military history at the University of North Texas, professor of strategic studies at the U.S. Naval War College, host of numerous TV shows on the History Channel, and author of today's book, A Mad Catastrophe, The Outbreak of World War I and the Collapse of the Habsburg Empire. Jeff, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Emily.
There's quite a lot of other accolades there that I didn't mention. I'm very excited to have you here. And first, we're going to start in... So your book starts in the 1800s, which you kind of have to in order to understand why World War I happened. You do have to at least go back to the 19th century. Can I ask you real quick, your book focuses on the Eastern Front, and I wanted to just throw out there what the difference is generally between the Eastern and the Western Front.
Okay. Eastern Front essentially is the front where Germany and Russia, and Germany along with Austria-Hungary, fight the Russian Empire for most of the war. And the Western Front is you know, where the German army launches the Schlieffenplan and wheels into France in August 1914. And with this plan of enveloping Paris and with it, the entire French army and winning the war in 6 or 7 weeks by knocking out France and then shuttling the entire German army fighting in Belgium and France eastward to join the Austrians, the Russians. So it was always assumed that there'd be a sort of a 1-2 punch. The German army would mass against the French and the small British expeditionary force, roll them up, beat them, knock them out of the war, and then move everything east to, you know, deal with the rush.
Yeah, they thought it would be over pretty quickly. Both sides were like, this will be 40 days or something like that. And they're like, we're going to be done soon. But no.
But of course, it was really attended by a lot of just really stupid assumptions and a real inattention to detail. You know, I mean, the whole Schlieffenplan had come to unravel before it was ever launched, not least because Russian preparedness improved so much. And the Schlieffenplan was founded on the fact that it would take the Russians 6 or 7 weeks to mobilize their army. I mean, this was, Russian army was an army that in 1914, your average reservist was 700 miles from his depot, right? And he had to get there walking or on a horse cart or maybe a train would get him there part of the way. So it's really slow and efficient. However, in the years before World War I, thanks to huge French loans, the Russians had really built out their railway network, especially the railways connecting them with what would be the German front and the Austro-Hungarian front of the war. So they now, these, where they had once had single track railways, they now had, you know, quadruple or 6-8-track railways. So they could have like 4 trains moving in both directions, sending stuff to the front. So the Russian mobilization times were much quicker in 1914 than had been anticipated in the writing of the Schlieffenplan. And everybody knew this, but they still pressed on with a kind of bewildering optimism.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask about that too, where you got France helping Russia out, and you brilliantly go over a lot of this for our listeners. You can read more about this in his book, but you go over how France helped Russia out building their railways. But then you have things like the Austrians who are way behind on this, but you'd think that because they're allied with Germany, who's a lot, I want to say, more efficient at building railway systems, but why was Austria so far behind in their rail systems and transport?
Well, they were ahead of the Russians until this big railway building program that was financed by the French, which really takes effect in the 5 or 6 years before World War I. And then they're completely surpassed by the Russians. And the French had been building railways there before, but they had this really intensive push that coincides with this great Russian army program, this buildup of the Russian army. But even so, compared to a country like Germany or France or Great Britain, Austria was very much second tier in terms of infrastructure. And it had a lot of reasons. It was a poorer country in terms of national income, in terms of per capita GDP, but also they had the infrastructure for the empire had to be divided between a Hungarian-ruled eastern half of the empire and a German-ruled western half of the empire. And just, you know, there were two parliaments, one in Vienna, one in Budapest. They argued over everything, including which railroads to prioritize and where to route them. You know, the Hungarians had totally different ideas about where the railroad should go than the Austrians. And so you ended up with inadequate and often poorly chosen infrastructure in both halves of the monarchy.
That's interesting. So it really is. It all goes back again and again to this kind of split between the Hungarian side and the Austrian side of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Like they really were kind of smashed together by the single monarchy. And I love how you open up to the book with Austria's dying. It's really weakened inside and has so many tensions inside before World War One. And both sides of the empire felt like they were giving in too much to the other. And it kind of affected the cohesiveness, it seems. So let's take us through a little bit of those tensions. I don't want to give too much away from your book, but you know, a lot of this is like people might know. The tensions inside the Austro-Hungarian Empire, they were amongst the German speaking and the non-German speaking, or what was a broad overall brushstroke of that, the tensions?
Well, you know, the Austrian Empire had been, you know, pulled together in the early modern period, you know, and when nationalism had not been a big factor, when it was perfectly okay for a Germanic dynasty to rule over Slavic or Romanian or, you know, Hungarian people. But in the age of nationalism, which certainly took hold in the 19th century, you know, you've got the Greek Revolution, then you've got, you know, driving out the church, creating a Greek state. You've got the Italians unifying and driving out the various princes there to unify the Italian peninsula. You have Germany like burying the 36 states of the German Confederation and unifying Germany between 1866 and 1871. And you have groups like, you know, Young Italy which have imitators inside the Austro-Hungarian Empire, like the Young Czechs, who are now saying, look, this is time for all of us to have national self-determination. Why are we still in the 19th century, this great age of modernism and progress? Why are we still governed by this, in the Western half, by these Habsburg tyrants, and in the Eastern half by these Magyar bigots, right? We want freedom. So this is festering and it's kept in check. You know, if you read like The Good Soldier Shrike, that great Czech novel by Jaroslav Hašek, where he, you know, he writes about, you know, the good soldiers fight and his fortunes in the Great War and his rambling around, you know, on all these various mobilizations and botched campaigns. And he's constantly commenting on the inefficiency of Austrian arrangements. But, you know, he talks about in the very beginning, he's sitting in a cafe and there's an undercover Austrian policeman at the next table listening into this conversation. And he kind of talks about how you have to have these conversations in the Austrian Empire where you avoid talking about anything sensitive because somebody's always listening. So they kind of repress it that way. And so they keep it in check, but I mean, it's still there and there's a great deal of resentment. You know, for example, Czechs, one of the most advanced nationalities in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, you know, there's a lot of Czech officers in the Austro-Hungarian army. They are not allowed to speak Czech. So even if they're sitting in a cafe in Prague with other Czech officers, they speak German. They're not allowed to speak Czech. So these kind of things in an age of nationalism are increasingly vociferous for the Austrians. And then you have all these languages disputes. For example, every major city wants a university faculty that teaches in its language. You know, so in Ljubljana, which they call Leibach, they want a Slovenian faculty. In Lemberg, which was Lviv, you know, they want a Ukrainian faculty or a Polish faculty. And in Prague, they want a Czech faculty alongside the German faculty at the Charles University. So, and then this goes down to the secondary and primary school levels as well. They want teaching in their vernacular. So all of these tensions are building. And, you know, what I say in the book is that this is a prime cause of the war is that Habsburgs are beginning to despair of ever finding a solution to this. And it's only going to get worse, not better. So maybe war is a solution because it allows to crack down, rally everybody around the flag, proclaim martial law, and try to pull everybody back together under the imperial banner.
So German-speaking population in the Austro-Hungarian Empire wasn't even the majority, but everything was officially German language and all these different, even the majority was Slavic population. And everybody's like, hey, we're not German-speaking and we want our own kind of identity.
And even more so on the Hungarian side.
I can imagine. I mean, just trying, even as an American today, trying to imagine the idea of the English population is the majority and there's another language that we have to speak instead. It would cause so much anger and tension. I can imagine what that would look like in that empire at the time. And they didn't have all the lessons of the world wars to guide them on what might happen from these tensions. You brought up a little bit of the like second tier idea of the Austrian military, and that really, really shocked me a lot reading the details in your book at how unprepared for war they were. You talk about the soldiers like greasing the guns so they won't rust and now the guns won't shoot. That was like, what? Having this idea of, oh, we need to be quiet at night so people don't find us. That like wasn't a concept for some of the Austrian army. Was that really surprising when you were digging into this a little bit more? Like you just go down the rabbit hole?
Somewhat, but not entirely. I mean, the reason I did this project was because my first book, my grad school dissertation, which became my first book, was called The Austro-Prussian War, Austria's War with Prussia and Italy in 1866. The first thing I was working on after that is my second book, and this ended up becoming my like fifth book or whatever instead, because all this stuff came up, was this book. When I wanted to sort of see how that army of 1866, how it evolved before 1914, and then how it fought in World War I. And so I started working on that straight away. And the reason I was interested is because these problems were already presenting themselves in 1866. You already had this problem of nationalism. It wasn't so well organized in the ranks, but like if you went into any of the provincial capitals, like Prague or Brunn or Lemberg or Lviv or Agram/Zagreb, Budapest certainly. I mean, there were huge misgivings about Habsburg rule, and there was real pushes for autonomy, for self government, for language rights, et cetera. And you saw this reflected in the army. And the army was also very kind of bureaucratically managed, poorly mobilized, poorly deployed, poorly led. And it sort of, just blundered from one loss to another. So I wanted to kind of follow that train and see how it evolves. Do they react to that defeat in 1866, which was really a cataclysmal defeat in that they were evicted from their outposts in Germany and in Italy and reduced to, what they now call themselves a Balkan power, right? And so what I discovered was that they did not really react. It seems that it's not really in the Austrian nature to kind of absorb lessons learned and arrange fixes. There's a lot of what the Viennese call schmäh, just kind of making excuses and blaming and pointing a finger at others. And it was partly a result of the system. The system was poor. It was not an industrial powerhouse. It was richer than Italy. It was richer than Serbia. But it was quite a bit poorer than the great industrial powerhouses like Germany and France, Great Britain, and even Russia. So, I mean, on a per capita basis, richer than Russia, but Russia has a lot more going for it. So they muddled through. That's a famous Austrian word, Fortwurstel, sausage through things, muddle through things. They make the best of what they have, but they never have enough. And so there's all kinds of data on this in the book, how before the war breaks out in 1914, only one man out of every 132 military aged men in Austria is a soldier versus one out of every 65 in France and versus one out of every 95 in Russia, right? So they're not, and the reason is because drafting and training people is expensive, so they furlough everybody. You're draft eligible, but you don't get drafted because it would cost the state too much money to to bring you in, house you, feed you, train you. So they have all these furloughed people that were never trained, who were then called up in 1914. Add to that a complete absence of artillery. They're still fighting with bronze field guns and, you know, left over from the late 19th century. Everybody else has gone to steel, obviously. And they don't have howitzers, no heavy artillery, just light field artillery. And they don't have nearly enough machine guns, hardly any. They don't have any aviation, right? So all the, you know, when you look at the great spending programs in France, the three-year law in 1913, German Army's army program on the eve of World War I, 1912, 1913, the Russian Great Army program, 1913, they all involve kind of trying to bring these armies up to full strength with modern arms. And so they're huge, you know, they build out the railways, they add howitzers, heavy artillery, they add light field artillery, they add machine gun units, they add telegraph and units, they add railway engineer units, they add aviation units, everything to make these armies more modern and more hard-hitting. Yeah. Austria does none of that, none of that, for the simple reason of costs. The Austro-Hungarian Empire in 1914 is spending five times more on its civil service, on its bureaucrats, than it is on the war ministry, to give you an idea. I mean, as if the Pentagon budget was dwarfed was a fifth of the budget of the federal bureaucracy in Washington.
Okay, so that kind of actually explains the whole thing of like those wars breaking out. When it first breaks out, those Austrian officials just go on vacation. Like some of them just, they're like, oh, it's vacation time. That kind of the attitude, the sausage through things, which I hope to never say again, but that explains that attitude.
Well, it's always translated as muddle through, but it's forceful, and that means sausage through in German.
That's awful. That's an awful thing to say.
You know, I speak a lot about the problem of being commanded by an 84-year-old emperor who's really sickly. He's allowed. How people were observing Joe Biden at the end of his presidency and like looking at all these signs of his aging. And you have the same thing going on in Vienna with, you know, foreign observers, you know, journalists, attachés, diplomats constantly like eyeing the Austrian emperor, Franz Josef, and sending home reports about his various illnesses and what medications he was on and why he was no longer moving from the summer palace to the winter palace. Staying year round in the summer palace because he was so ill and so weak. So, you know, so he was increasingly of the view, even though he viewed himself as an emperor of peace, especially after the assassination of Franz Ferdinand, which he sees as like just an open provocation by the Serbs.
And
he passed her with force. But, you know, if you looked at the hard realities, there was no way they should have taken war.
It's almost surprising that considering the weakness that they were suffering from and the condition of their emperor, it's almost surprising that someone didn't invade them and try to take their territory, or like Russia doing that. It's a little surprising.
Well, because they always had the German alliance, you know, since 1879. Right. So Russia was pondering that in 1908 when Austria annexed Bosnia-Herzegovina. And the Russians nearly go to war with Austria to contest that because they think Bosnia should go to Serbia, a Russian ally.
Yeah.
And the Russians back down because of German.
And the Russians just kind of stayed back a little, poking, instead of invading, just, you know, hey, Serbia, if you mess with Austria, we got your back kind of thing.
Well, also in 1908, the Russians had just emerged from the defeat in the Russo-Japanese War. So they were busy rebuilding everything, the army and the navy. They weren't ready. By 1914, they're ready, so they don't care what the Germans are going to say. They're ready to go to war now.
Yeah, that's a good point. And to be fair to Austria, though, I feel like we're pounding Austria a little bit, but to be fair to them, the general idea that World War One was such a crazy thing in that across the board, armies were not officially supplied sufficiently. Their soldiers sometimes didn't have boots or proper socks or guns, and that was everywhere, even in the U.S. And there's a famous story, famous amongst World War One historians, about Teddy Roosevelt von Quinten, who fought and died in World War One. And he like went to a captain's office to demand that his men be supplied with boots because they were training in the mud, like freezing mud without boots. And he basically challenged the captain to like, let's take off our uniforms and fist fight. And it almost happened, but somebody came in and stopped it. And the captain's like, who the hell was that guy? And when I'm court-martialed, and they're like, that's Teddy Roosevelt's son. And he's right. Give everybody boots. And from that point on, they're like, you have to give everybody boots. And it kind of earned him the admiration of all these men. But it always stuck with me, this idea that it's not just Eastern Europe that's having supply issues. It's not just Britain. It's the U.S. too, in World War One, who at least at first weren't even giving boots to their soldiers sometimes. So try to be fair to Austria a little bit.
But if you know, the only way to realistically look in the situation, compare themselves with peer competitors, right? Mm. And they were so far behind that it was absolutely lunatic to consider going to war. And yet they did.
Okay. I want to ask you about something on this note before I forget. There was a story you were telling in the book about part of the Austrian army, part of the German army coming together somewhere in Poland, I think it was, where they were going to attack Russia. And this German officer commented, the Austrians make a clueless and disorganized impression. Many don't understand German. In general, even the Russian prisoners make more of a military impression than these Austrian tramp soldiers who arrive everywhere too late. Tick, burn. Oh my God. That is like, even the Germans, their allies were like, Jesus, Austria. Was that an across the board feeling in the German military about Austria?
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, there was definitely a lack of confidence and a lack of affection in the German army for the Austrians. You know, they described themselves as being shackled to a corpse. But, you know, think about the Austrian army versus the Russian army. They're both, you know, on a per capita basis, pretty poor. Austria, quite a bit richer, actually. But nothing like the Northern European industrial powers in terms of their ability to equip. As an example of that, you know, that one thing I found in writing this book was that the six divisions of the British Expeditionary Force, the ones that will go over to France in 1914 and fight in the Battle of the Marne, the British government spent more on those six divisions every year than the Austro-Hungarian army spent on its 48 divisions every year.
What?
That's factoid alone. So the British weren't short on boots and socks and trousers and rifles and, yeah, they run short of shells like every army, but they've got the stuff they need because they're spending. The Austrians are making economies in every area, just treating this as kind of a shell. So, but anyway, the point is like, but the Russians were mujiks, you know, they're peasants for the most part, and they're tough, you know. And when the Germans would talk about the army, they say these are like shopkeepers, artisans. They come from like small towns. They live in comfort. They work a short day. They go have their beer. They sleep under a roof. And they're just not used to campaigning. Whereas the Russians, they've been out in the fields in, you know, terrible weather, working all the time, hardened by the elements. And they don't mind all this marching and fighting and freezing and heat, you know? So
yeah,
you know, there was that difference, you know, Austria's higher level of development in some ways worked against it in this kind of a war. And then of course the Germans noticed, you know, that although there is a language of command in the Austro-Hungarian army, which is German, you know, everybody has to learn, you know, a few dozen words of German, and they rarely do, or they rarely are very good at it. So there's confusion, but you know, especially as the first line troops all get killed off in 1914, and they start bringing in these untrained drafts of men, they don't know the command. They only speak their vernacular, right? And so they've got officers barking at them in an unfamiliar language. They're not responding as good. And so the Germans notice all this,
so they can't even be like, hey, go storm that hill or go whatever, because the soldiers are like, I don't even know what you're saying to me right now.
Or they pretend they don't.
I'm not going to lie. Like, I might be one of those people that's like, I'm pretending I don't understand you wanting me to go die over there. So I wanted to ask about, okay, so the Russians, they had this nickname, the Steamroller, in World War One, and famously in World War Two, they were at least sometimes called the Meat Grinder, just because of this sheer amount of population and soldiers that they had. And that's kind of in World War One, they just steamrolled over everyone. We got all these friggin' people. Did any other army have a nickname like that?
No, I mean, that was, and I think that was coined in the British press, okay, like in one of the tabloid newspapers. One day they talked about the Russian army is so big, it's like a steamroller or roll over the Germans and the Austrians.
Okay, so another thing about Russia, I wanted to ask, you had said that before World War One, Russia had this policy where they're like, we're not going to build hardened roads past somewhere in the middle of Poland. And that was to make it harder for people to invade Russia. But did they ever consider, or was it maybe just not a priority, that one day they're going to have to invade someone else and they need those hardened roads?
Well, I mean, they also, of course, had a different railroad gauge, right? So if you were a German army riding the rails east or an Austrian army riding the rails northeast into Russia, you'd have to stop at the border and switch over to the Russian grade, right?
Thank God.
And that was obviously near impossible, right? If the Russians had withdrawn all their trains, right? So, and these were, and the reason being that, you know, this Russian attempt to build out the infrastructure on the eve of World War One was quite impressive, but still a little behindhand. And so it was always Russia's strategy to keep a would-be invader at arm's length as long as possible so that Russia could rake in recruits from all over the empire and form them into corps to get them to the threatened frontiers before a more efficient Western could drive, you know, into Russia and wreak havoc.
I see. Well, the Russians definitely seem to be very good at, what's it phrased, the Princess Bride. Classic blunder is don't start a land war in Asia. And that's true in both world wars where you're like, you're not going to get in the Russian. The Russians seem very good at stopping that. So, yeah.
Training space for time.
Yeah. And so, okay, before we move on from the Russians, I have another question about them, or kind of, what is the difference between the Russian trenches and, let's say, Western European trenches in World War One? Was there a big difference?
Well, the frontage in the east is, you know, so much bigger than the Western front, you know, from the channel to the Swiss border, you know, four times as big, five times as big, depending on how you measure it. And so, and they're not fighting continuously heavily along this front as the Western front, you know, certainly the 60 miles controlled by the British, are, you know, constantly under attack. So the British are constantly fending off, you know, or preparing for attacks there or counterattacks there. And the French on their 150 miles or so front are doing the same thing. And there's very few quiet areas. And even the quiet areas become not quiet when Germans say, okay, we're going to attack a quiet area and take them by surprise, right? So you have to be ready to shift forces. It takes a long time because of the thin infrastructure to mass troops in a certain area, and then you strike. So in terms of trenches, I mean, it's not nearly like these concreted fortifications you have on the Western Front, where you have sandbag trenches and you'll have dugouts underground with, you know, rebar and reinforced bombproof shelters. It's more primitive on the Eastern Front, just because it's really much more of a war of movement. For the same reason, you have more cavalry fighting as cavalry.
So they're not having here's a little station for your teacup, like they eventually had in the West. Like the Russians are like, we're not doing teacup stations. And we're not putting flower boxes like the French are.
And because of that, you know, when battles do flare up, sometimes it's in an area where they don't have proper trenches. And if it happens in November or December, as often happens, ground's too hard to dig. So you'll have these Russian and Austrian armies or German and Russian armies fighting and unable to entrench because they're hiding behind like branches and tree trunks and because they can't dig into the frozen ground.
What are you going to do? Yeah. So you have all this, you know, trenches are coming up. We're talking a lot about rail systems and hardened roads and, you know, factories being able to produce ammunition and all this stuff. And there was now in World War One, a new thing was canned food that could supply the soldiers and obviously the cars that could move people and supplies and all this. Who was it that said that they didn't think trains and canned food would even be useful militarily? Was that the emperor, or am I thinking of something else?
Did I say that in the book?
Somebody said like, it's never going to be useful. And I was like, what the hell? What? Like, but you know, people said that kind of stuff back then.
Now, canned food was definitely like useful. Especially with the maintenance of empires, because you have to send these rations out around the globe. I don't remember coming across that in my research.
It might not have been you. It might have been just something I read at some point where I was like, this is crazy.
Nor do I remember any of them eating canned food. They were all chickpeas and stuff like that.
Yeah. It always reminds me of, there's this guy in 1500s England that was complaining about pillows, because pillows started to become a thing. And he was like, who are these young people that need their pillows? Pillows are stupid and it's a passing fad. And it's like, why are you complaining? Like, who would complain about pillows or canned food? That's super weird. So, but before we go here, I wanted to ask one more thing. There's this thing with the Austrian and German relationship. Obviously, they were allies, and that deteriorated over time. And at some point, Austria was trying to negotiate peace without even talking to Germany. But there was a cutoff of communications around that time between the two allies. Was that just like a total cutoff of communications?
Well, I mean, the Sixtus Affair, which refers to the Austrian Emperor Franz Joseph dies in 1916. He's replaced by Emperor Karl I, his nephew. And Karl I is very aggrieved by German high-handedness, and he's very well aware that the Germans are fighting this war to the last Austrian and kind of using the Austrians as cannon fodder. So he's looking for ways out, not least because he wants to get out so that he can preserve the Austro-Hungarian Empire. If the Central Powers lose this war outright, then they're going to break up the Austrian Empire into its constituent nations, in line with, Wilson's 14 points and that sort of thing. So he's trying to get ahead of this. And so he reaches out to the allies, and Sixtus, who's related to his wife and is a Belgian prince. And he says, we'll get, and the allies offer very mild terms. They just say, look, give up some territory, and the French, resumption of control over Alsace-Lorraine, stop fighting, we'll preserve the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Mm-hmm. And so he says, I'll do that. But then, typical Austro-Hungarian muddling through, instead of just doing it, he dithers for a year. So a year later, Clemenceau's pissed off the French premier because the Austrians haven't delivered. And so they do to the Austrians what Hitler does to Italy after the Allied invasion of Italy in 1943. And then Italy switches, takes Austria, even though they never actually switched sides.
Yeah.
And then basically everything, Austrian economy, Austrian railroads, Austrian army, it all falls under German.
It's really interesting. Americans generally have this impression of Austria being like the elegant of the Germans and like the sophisticated of the German speaking world. And you're like, that's, I don't know, like it to some degree, but there's more there. If you look like 100 years ago.
The Viennese always had that conceit about the kind of truculent, crass Prussian quadrupeds. Because the Prussians were very Lutheran and there'd be a lot of these pietistic groups. So they were real Bible thumpers. And they were really sort of threadbare. They were parsimonious. The Viennese were rich because they came from this rich land, Baroque palaces, and they partied well, and they had the best manners. The Prussians were kind of, there was a Prussian king who famously wore coat sleeves because he didn't want to wear out his tunic, signing reports, right? So the Austrians always considered them better than them. That's why in 1866, they assumed they would win the Austro-Prussian War easily.
Sure.
They were a more militarily distinguished great power. And everybody in Europe thought were. So, but the monarchy weakens in the modern age, for sure.
Yeah. Well, I want to let viewers know that among the many, many books that you've written, you also just came out with a book on the Vietnam War. And we're doing a little series of interviews on Vietnam in the summer. And I'd love to have you back if you're available. But yes, Jeffrey Warrow, thank you so much for joining us. Great book, A Mad Catastrophe, The Outbreak of World War One, and The Collapse of the Habsburg Empire. You can get on Amazon and anywhere else you get books. Again, thank you so much and Happy New Year.
Same to you. Thanks a lot, Emily. Right, see you next time.
Bye.